afternoon in the Lord. If you have your Bibles, turn to the book of Nehemiah in the Old Testament. Nehemiah chapter 6. And we're only going to read a couple of verses. And the reason we're only going to read a couple of verses is because we really need to read like six chapters. And we don't, of course, wouldn't have time to do that. Nehemiah is basically in two parts. And the reason that Nehemiah is in two parts is because it originally, my understanding was, it originally was one book in the Hebrew Bible. And it composes kind of the story of Nehemiah and Ezra. Or Nehemiah and Ezra were one book originally in the Hebrew Bible. So you have interwoven the story of Nehemiah, and you have the emphasis on Nehemiah, what God was doing through his life, and you also have brought into it the account of Ezra. We're going to read a couple of verses, Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 15 and verse 16. The Bible said, "So the wall was finished on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. And when all our enemies heard of it, all the nations around us were afraid and fell greatly in their own esteem. For they perceived that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God." And those are the two verses that we're going to begin with tonight. Now, I'm going to make an assumption, and I don't think it's an assumption because I know that all of you read your Bible, that you may not have read the book of Nehemiah in the last week. And you may not have read the book of Nehemiah in the last month, but I know that you're familiar with the book of Nehemiah. One of the great themes of the book of Nehemiah is that it's post-exile. A number of people have come back to Jerusalem, come back to the land, and they're trying to reestablish themselves in the land. Nehemiah is still in exile, and he is given a report of how bad things are at home, in their homeland, in particular, how that the walls of the city are broken down and the gates are destroyed by fire, and the people are basically living in a state of reproach. And when he hears that news, it's not just the news of the tragic circumstances of his people back home. It's not just the news of the terrible condition of the city. But I think it's fair to say that to him, he is concerned not only with that, but he's concerned with the reproach that this would bring upon the name of God, because these are the people of God, and they were the ones who professed to be the ones who had been chosen and who were the followers of the true God. And the story kind of unfolds over, in particular, these first six chapters of how that God works through Nehemiah and how that God works through the people to bring about the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. And I just, as I was praying this afternoon, I began to think about this, and I began to go and read it, and I began to see that this is a wonderful picture of how that whenever God is going to do something, the ways in which God works. Now, I used to hear a man say this, and I believe it's true. You have to figure out where God is sending you, and don't go unless he's sending you. You go where you're sent, and if you've been sent by God, you should go. And God will bless your labors wherever God sends you. And I think that one of the great problems in contemporary professing Christianity is a lot of people are going without being sent. A lot of people are, you know, I heard it said one time, the need is the call. But that can't be true, because the need's everywhere. I mean, you know, if every time we had a missionary come and show us the need in a particular area or a particular country, and we said, well, that must mean that we're called. Well, the need would be endless, and we would be going everywhere, and we wouldn't have any sense of God sending us to a particular place to do a particular work. The need's everywhere. I mean, the need's here. The need's where you work. The need's in your family. The need's in your neighbors. There's no place that the need is not. I mean, there's a need here in this area with, you know, people who are materially impoverished and who need care in that way. But there's needs everywhere. The question is, what am I supposed to do? Where am I supposed to go? And where will God bless me? I remember when I was going to the prisons, I was in a place where I was able to do a little bit of reading on Brother Blackaby's study, Experiencing God. And the one great thing I remember about that is that the great thing about it is he's teaching us this simple truth. Don't go work where you think you ought to go work. Find out where God's working. And then you join God in what God is doing, where God is sending you, and where God is calling you. And I began to think about this early part of this book of Nehemiah and how that, you know, God is working to bring about this rebuilding of the walls and the restoration of the people in the land. And to me, it is a great, great lesson or a set of lessons about how God brings about the working of His purposes. Now, it's an interesting thing. God works His purpose, and God is the one that does the work, but He also uses human instrumentalities in the working of that purpose. I heard a preacher say one time, he had a piece of property that was all grown up and it was all full of nettles and briars and everything. And he said he had purchased the property and he went in there and cleaned the property up. He worked for days on the property. He was cutting bushes and cleaning fence rows and doing everything. And a neighbor come by and, you know, recognizing him to be a pastor, he said, well, the Lord's got Himself a nice piece of property here. And the pastor said, I said to him, yes, He does, but it didn't look this good when He's the only one that was working on it, you know. And he's making a point that, you know, that yes, God, everything we have is God's, and God ultimately does the work, but God uses human instrumentalities in the working of His purposes. And there's a number of lessons here in this early part of this book that I think helps us as we think about whenever God is doing something in the world. This tells of a great call upon a person, but also a great call upon a people. It is not only God's call upon Nehemiah, but it's also God's call upon the people that God is going to use along with Nehemiah to bring about a change of things in Jerusalem. It's a great work. Nehemiah keeps making reference to the fact that it's a great work. It's an important work. It's a significant work. It is a large work. It is a difficult work. And yet when we come to the verses that we read as we began a moment ago, the work has been done and God has given glory for the doing of this work. So let's think about just briefly some of these truths throughout these first six chapters of this book. First of all, is this truth here, is that God's work is usually brought about when God lays a burden on someone's heart. You know, God burdens someone about a particular thing. In chapter 1, the Bible said that when Nehemiah is given the report of what's going on back in the land, he said this, "As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven." Now, immediately you see a man who is concerned. He's concerned not just in a normal way. You know, we all see things that we say, well, there's a great need and that concerns me. And then we kind of go on with our lives and we may pray about it. We may think about it. We may even give money to that particular cause. But it doesn't really grip our hearts in the sense that this grips the heart of Nehemiah. Now, I know just, I don't want to be personal or tell personal stuff, but I've just thought about this throughout the afternoon. I remember when God was calling me to go to the prisons, I invited a man to come to our church that I was serving, and he had pastored 28 years, and God had called him to leave the pastorate. He was an older man by them. His wife was not a young lady, and they felt the call of God to go into the prisons and preach the gospel. He had began to go into the prisons down in western Kentucky, and he was raising financial support so that they could survive financially, much like we support missionaries. And he had some connections to this area, and some other pastors up here contacted me and asked if I would let him come to our church. They came on a Sunday morning, and he got up and told about how God had dealt with his heart, and he got up and preached that morning. His wife got up and told about the burden that God had given her about working with the families when they come on the days of visitation to see their dads or their, you know, husbands or whatever. And I remember sitting back there, you know, just God began to really stir my heart. I just remember just God began to, I just never even thought of the prisons as an opportunity for ministry or mission service or as an open door to go in and preach the gospel. I have to honestly say, that had never even entered my mind to do anything like that or to pursue anything like that or even to call a jail or a prison or to preach. Not that I was above that, but it just had never been upon my heart. As they were speaking that day, it's just like God began to, just work in my heart. And I began to get interested and begin to think about it and begin to get concerned about it. When he left, he asked me to come down to Western Tennessee to the prison he was working in. They were going to have a prison revival, and asked if I would come down, stay with him and his wife, and come into the meetings and preach. And I said, well, I would love to do that. And I made that trip, and here's what I remember about that trip. I was so moved. I was so moved by what I witnessed in that trip that God just gripped my heart. And I remember leaving that night and saying, is anybody doing this up in Kentucky? And they go, well, probably people are preaching in the prisons, but nobody with our ministry is working in the prisons of Kentucky. And I drove 4 hours that night across the state through the dark. And I remember God just dealing with my heart and me praying, God, send somebody. God, move on someone's heart. This is such an important ministry. This is such a worthy ministry to take the gospel into the prisons and to preach the gospel to the men and women in prisons. And I come home and I couldn't shake that. I mean, you think, well, come home and go back about your business, and it would just kind of be something in the back of your mind. I just could not get beyond it. I couldn't shake it. It was just with me every single day. I prayed about it continually. I was just moved about it. And I remember praying, Lord, send someone to the prisons of Kentucky like, you're sending people to the prisons of other states. And, of course, I mean, the point of my story is that he was sending me. He was burdening me. He was giving me a concern that I did not have before that. He was opening my eyes to a need in a way. You might have come to me before that and said, do you believe there's a need for people to go in and preach the gospel? I would have said, oh yeah, there's a need for people to go into the prisons and preach the gospel. But God put me in a place where he really burdened my heart about a particular work. God burdened my heart about this ministry, and in particular ministry in the prisons of this state. And I don't want to talk about myself, and I'm in no way trying to elevate myself, but whenever God is going to do something, whenever God is going to bring about a work or accomplish a work, usually it begins with God burdening someone's heart about that work. Many of the churches across our land are here because at some point God burdened someone about a community that needed a gospel preaching church. And, it might have been a man moved into a community as a farmer, or he might have moved in as a businessman, he might have moved in as any number of things. And when he began to see the condition of the community, the spiritual condition of the community, God began to burden his heart and trouble his heart, and he began to see a need, and it was a need that he couldn't shake. It wasn't something that, oh, here's the need, and then he could go on with his life. And God was burdening his heart. And I'll say this too. I don't fully understand this, but I think that most of you have witnessed this, and you would agree with this. Whenever God is going to save an individual, he burdens people's heart for that individual. He burdens someone in their life that with a deep concern for them, and they begin to pray over them and weep over them and witness to them and invite them to the Lord's house. I've literally, and you probably have too, I've literally been in services where you could almost feel the burden that rests upon the heart of the church for a lost person. A lost person maybe that was or was not there. Maybe someone in the service, or maybe someone, the husband of a lady in the church, or a child of a family in the church, and you could just feel the great concern and the great burden for this person. And often, it's been my experience anyway, often that whenever you see that, eventually that person is saved as the church labors under this burden and prays desiring that God would bring this person from death to life. So God's work is usually begins when God gives someone a burden, when God creates a concern, a desire, a compassion, a brokenness. He works in a heart usually before he works in the world. He works in an individual heart usually before he works on a larger scale and in a broader way. You know, a lot of times it may begin with one person. The whole story of the China Inland Mission begins with the burden that God put on Hudson Taylor, a man. God put on his heart. The whole story of that mission began with the burden that God put upon that one man's heart, and then it grew into much more than just one man or one ministry. So God's work is often done when he gives someone a burden, and he gave Nehemiah a burden. Nehemiah just, you know, Nehemiah had a pretty good deal here, didn't he? He had a pretty good life. He was in a high place. He was probably in a comfortable place. But when he heard the news of what was going on back in Jerusalem, he immediately became burdened and troubled and moved. And he began to pray and begin to fast and begin to seek God. Another thing, number two, I just said it. God's work is often brought about when God sets our hearts to pray. You know, here we have a man who, he is burdened about what's going on back in Jerusalem, and he begins to pray about it. He begins to seek the face of God about it. He weeps. He mourns. And he doesn't just weep and mourn, but we're told that he weeps and mourns for days. He fasts and he prays before the God of heaven. And as you read the chapters, you know, from chapter 1 over to verse 6, you see his prayers woven into the story, that he's always seeking God. And, you know, whenever God's, you know, doing something, whenever God is working out his purpose, usually he sets his people to pray. He gives a burden, and from that burden comes a seeking of the face of God. I'm convinced of this. If we ever see an outpouring of the Holy Spirit in like a real revival in our day and time, what we'll see before that is a burdened church and a prayerful church. That's what we'll see before. Before the Spirit falls, we'll see the people broken and the people praying. And until we're broken and praying, we can't expect the Spirit to fall. Yeah, I know God is sovereign. He can do anything he wants to do, whenever he wants to do, the way he wants to do it. But it seems to me, just from, you know, what we know about church history, that whenever God is going to pour out his Spirit in large measure, he burdens his people and he brings them to prayer. He draws them to prayer. And you know, prayer is the fruit of a burden, right? If you've got a burden, you pray. If you're concerned, you pray. Because the things we're talking about are not things we can do on our own. It's not, you know, these are, you know, if we talk about God sending revival, we can't affect that. Only God can do that, you know. And God can give us a concern, and God can give us a burden, and God can bring about a brokenness and a desire and a seeking of his face. But then after that, we must pray. We just go to God in prayer and seek his face and seek his guidance and seek his direction and seek his power and seek his help and seek his deliverance. A burdened heart becomes a praying heart. And what we see here is Nehemiah, who's burdened about what the condition of the state of affairs back in Jerusalem, his burden moves him to broken prayer. And he begins to seek the face of God. And he prays to, he doesn't just say, oh, I've got a good idea, and walk into the king and say, here, I've got a good idea. Let me leave my post and go back to Jerusalem, and I've got all kinds of plans. He goes to God first. And he seeks the face of God. And then he goes to the king. And even as he's going to the king, he's praying and seeking the face of God. And even as he's back in Jerusalem and the work is going on, he has to pray and deal with the issues that come up throughout the course of that. So God's work is done when God gives someone a burden. And God's work is done when he sets our hearts to praying. Another thing is God's work is done when he calls someone to lead. Now, what we have here is not just the story of the burden that God gives Nehemiah, not just the story of the praying of Nehemiah, but we really have here, all woven into this, is the story of the calling of Nehemiah. God is calling him to do a work. God is calling him to go back to Jerusalem, and God is calling him to lead the people in the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. Nehemiah is being called. His life is being turned in a different direction, isn't it? I mean, God's laid his hand upon him. God has chosen him. God is going to use him. God is going to bless him. And God has stepped into his life. And God stepped into his life, as far as what we see, God steps into his life by a report that comes back, that comes to him from Jerusalem, and God begins to work in his life to call him and to send him back to Jerusalem. He would be the instrument that God would use to move others in this work. He would be the one that would, he would be the one that would have the vision. He would be the one that would be, the burden would begin with him, and the praying would begin with him, and the vision would be, kind of drawn out in his heart. And then he would be the one that would go back to the people in Jerusalem, and that would move, that God would use him to move them to undertake this great work. Whether we like it or not, God usually, whenever in a ministry or whatever, God usually calls someone, to lead. God, usually in the case of like starting churches, God usually calls a family, doesn't he? Calls a minister and calls a family and gives them the burden and moves them to pray, and then sends them to a particular place to do a particular work, and to, they're the ones that God lays their hand upon, and then they must lead this effort in the will of God. And, God's work is done usually when he calls someone to lead. Now, I challenge you to go back through the Bible and just think about that as you read your Bible. Didn't God call Moses and send Moses so that the people could be delivered from their bondage in the land of Egypt? It was, we've been looking at Elijah on Sunday morning. God called Elijah to stand up and confront the idolatry and the sin of Ahab and Jezebel. And then God called Elisha to take his place. And God called Joshua to take the place of Moses. And God called Samuel in the dark days of Eli and Hophni and Phinehas and those days of, spiritual drift. So God's work is done. Often when we see God calling someone, burdening them, moving them to prayer, and they're the ones that God has chosen to begin a work and to lead a work that he is, desirous to accomplish. Another thing, God's work can be done when the task seems overwhelming. I don't know what kind of picture when you read these chapters, what kind of picture you get of this, but here's the picture I get of this. The picture I get of this is that if I'd walked up to the city of Jerusalem, or I'd made Nehemiah's trip, remember he goes at night and he goes and surveys the terrible state of things and he goes around the city, I'd have went, well, man, this is too far gone. We can't do this. That's human nature. It's just too big of a task. It's too big of a problem. We're going to have to stand back and reevaluate. The situation was dire. The situation was dire because of the people, and the situation was dire because of the vastness of the enterprise itself. The people were in a terrible state. I'll say more about that in a minute. It said that they were in great trouble and shame. They were in a bad way. The people were surely living in poverty. They were living in, bad and difficult circumstances. There's one point that when they're working on the walls, that the rubble becomes a problem because it's such a vast building enterprise, and the rubble becomes a problem, and they have to deal with the issue of the rubble so that they can continue to work and continue to build. It was a large, daunting, difficult task. But, God can work even when the task seems overwhelming. I mean, the work may seem impossible. Now, let me give you another example. One of my favorite things in the book of Acts is how the Apostle Paul would go into a pagan city in what to every, I mean, just to our way of thinking, it would seem impossible, and he would leave a Christian church behind. That, I mean, he would go, he wasn't going into the Bible Belt where everybody knew about the Bible and everybody had a Bible and everybody had some affiliation with the church or knew something about a church. I mean, he was going to Salt Lake City into the heart of Mormonism and preaching Jesus Christ. He was going into the darkest and most difficult situations where just thinking of the way that men are and the prejudice that they have in their hearts against the gospel, you would think, well, there's no way a church can be started here. And he would leave and there'd be a church. Because God's work can be done even though the task seems overwhelming. Another thing, God's work can be done with the most unlikely of people in the most unlikely of circumstances. As I said a moment ago, the picture here of the people in the land is one of, you know, they're not in good shape. I don't think that they're wealthy. I think that they are, we're told that they're living in a state of trouble. And it's, the word in chapter 1 is, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. They're in bad shape. I mean, this is not, they're probably a disorganized society in some measure, probably trying to put their lives back together as they've come back out of the exile. And, you know, this is not what you would think is a people that it would be easy to bring about this, the accomplishment of this great task with. You know, we all have this idea, I do. You look at a situation and you think, well, this could be done here and this can't be done here. You'd have probably looked at the people and thought, well, this can't be done, you know, because these are not wealthy people, or there's not many of them. There would have been all kinds of impediments, you know, if you thought about it in a natural way. You know, there'd be all kinds of impediments. But the wonderful thing about the Lord is the Lord can... He can accomplish His work with the most unlikely people. He doesn't use, you know, the Lord doesn't use the people that we often think He would, and He often does use the people that we think He would. And, you know, one of the problems with the church here in America, in my opinion, one of the problems with the church here in America is we think too much like the world. We think like the world. That's why the church tries to function so often like the world. They try to run the church by worldly principles. You know, we try to market Jesus to the world instead of preach Jesus to the world, because we believe that somehow that, you know, Jesus ain't good enough on His own. We've got to help Him out, and we've got to use some kind of worldly scheme or method to help God work. And that's not true. That's simply not true. Same way, you know, people would look at the church and go, well, you've got to have so much wealth in the church or you can't do anything. Listen, if it's of God, it will go. You know, I heard the story of a minister one time, and he was in a parish, and they thought he'd begin to lose his mind. And the reason they thought he'd begin to lose his mind, because every day at 12 noon, he would walk out of his parsonage and he would go down and stand by a bridge, and at 12 o'clock every day a train would come through. And when the train would come through, he'd throw his hat up in the air and go, whoo! And he did it every day, and people got to watching him. They thought he was losing his mind. Finally, somebody got the courage to ask him. They were afraid he was something wrong with him, and they said, Pastor, we're really concerned about you. People in the community have been watching you every day at noon go down to the bridge, and when the train comes by, you throw your hat up in the air and you shout. People are beginning to talk. Why in the world are you doing that? He goes, because that's the only thing in my parish that I don't have to push to make it go. And I thought that was interesting, you know. But the reality is, if God's in it, we don't have to push it. If God's in it, He makes a way, doesn't He? God will... And you know, these people, you know, it's amazing. God can, in our study on in James on Wednesday night or Thursday night, we've been at that section of James where James talks about the sin of favoritism in the church. Where if you had a wealthy man come in and you go, oh, it's so good to have you, and come over here, sit in a good place, sit by me. And then in that context, the poor man comes in and he has the literal word in the Greek is dirty clothes. He's got shabby clothing on and he doesn't look like he, and you go, well, oh, you take the guy with the gold ring and the fancy clothes and you put him in a good pot, and the other one you say, oh, sit here under my feet. You know, he said, you become judges of evil thoughts. And, you know, the reason that that would ever be done is because people would think, well, this person has means, they could, the church, they would help the church, and the other person doesn't have means, and they would maybe be a drag upon the church's resources instead of an add to the church's resources. But I'm telling you, we should never, ever, with the help of God, we should never think that way. God will take the most unlikely people and make them the greatest blessings. God will take, you know, the most unlikely people who maybe have, in the worldly sense, the least to contribute, and in the grace of God, they may contribute the most spiritually to the health and well-being of the body. God, in the working of His purposes, will use the most unlikely people. Another thing here in this 6 chapters is that God's work is done and can be accomplished when other people join in the work. One of the great things about this story is that Nehemiah knows he can't do this work on his own. Even though God has called him and God has laid his hand upon him, he knows he can't lay every brick. And that may not even, he may not even have those kind of skills. Who knows? He knows that there's going to have to be other people become involved in this work that God is moving his heart about. And it's wonderful, you know, he goes there. He doesn't tell anybody what God has put in his heart. He goes out and surveys the damage. And then he brings the leaders of the people in and he begins to unfold his heart and his burden and his calling to them. And with God's work in their heart, he enlists them and involves them in this work. And they join in wholeheartedly. I love what it says. They said, let us rise up and build. They wanted to build. God worked not only in his heart, God worked in their heart. And so they strengthened their hands, the Bible said, for the good work. They strengthened their hands. They said, we're gonna do this. We're gonna jump in wholeheartedly with both feet. We believe God has sent you. We believe God has called you. We believe God, this is God's will, and we're in, and we want to work. We want to help. And, you know, most great enterprises in the will of God, it's not a one-person enterprise. It involves others that God will touch the hearts of other people. It says in chapter 4, so we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Not just Nehemiah. The people had a mind to work. God's work is done when other people join in the work. You know, even in a church, small church, it takes people who are committed to Christ and people who believe in the ministry of the church and who believe in the preaching of the gospel and who love the church and love the Lord and love the work and want people to be saved and want people to hear the gospel. You know, it can't just be one person or two people, or, you know, God's work is accomplished through the labors of many, through the hearts of many. God gave them a heart for the work, and they become involved in the work, and they labored in the work, and eventually the work was finished for the glory of God. 3 more, and I'm done. God's work can be accomplished in spite of opposition. If you read these first six chapters, they had opposition from the beginning. They had threats. They had accusations. They knew opposition. This was not an unopposed work. You know, someone said, whenever God is going to do something, you can be sure the devil's going to oppose it. Yeah, that's pretty well true. God, if God is at work, Satan is going to rise up to oppose it. Chapter 2. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" They weren't rebelling against the king, but they were going to make a false accusation that they were rebuilding the wall so that they might rebel against the king. Now, Nehemiah said, "Then I replied, the God of heaven will make us prosper. We are his servants. We his servants will arise and build, but you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem." But they didn't stop there. They continued their efforts. They tried to compromise Nehemiah. They tried to, or threats. There was slander and accusations. They faced a lot of opposition. But you know what they did? They trusted God and they kept working. They trusted God and they kept going. They didn't quit when they faced opposition. This is a lesson the church in America is going to have to learn in the days going forward, that when we face opposition, we got to keep going. We can't lay down, because can you believe what's going on in our culture? Can you believe what they're saying? Can you believe what they're trying to do to the churches? We have to keep going in spite of the opposition. They trusted God and they worked, and God worked with them and through them. Another thing, God's work can be done over time as we trust Him and obey Him. Notice this was not the work of a day. This was the work of a lengthy period of time. Now, you say what the text that I read at the beginning, it was 52 days. But even at that, 52 days was not the end of the rebuilding of their lives in the land. This was not something that was just, oh, can you commit to 2 days? No, this was going to take a while. Daniel may have, all of you may have heard Alistair Begg say that a lot of times churches overestimate what God will do in the short term and underestimate what God will do in the long term. You know, a lot of pastors don't stay over a year or two now, because once the honeymoon's over, they go somewhere where they can have another honeymoon. And, you know, they think, and there is this expectation that, you know, I'm going to stay there 3 years and God's going to, you know, the whole community is going to come to Christ. That's not the way it is. It's not the way ministry is. It's not the way. And a lot of people, they get discouraged because they overestimate what can be accomplished in a short period of time. But they also are discouraged because they underestimate what God will do over a long period of time. Some works are works that have to be persevered in. And you can't just get discouraged and give up. They had to work on this a while, and they had to trust God, and they had to face opposition, and they had to obey God. And many of you probably remember Barry King telling the story down in Muscle Shoals about the guy that was in their ministry that felt called to start. They took an old church that had been forsaken and were reconstituting it, starting a church, and he went there for months and nobody came. But he believed, he was certain that God had called him to do this work there, and he kept going and he kept going, and finally, guess what? One Sunday, somebody came. I read one time that Adoniram Judson in India preached and labored 7 years before he had the first convert. God works often, you know, it's not like a sudden thing, but a lot of times it's the work that he does and accomplishes over a lengthy period of time that is the real thing that he's doing. And then lastly, and I've already said this, God works. God's work can be accomplished because God is Himself at work God is the one ultimately. That's, it's interesting. God is at work in this book, and the thread that runs through it is that, you know, Nehemiah is burdened and called, and Nehemiah goes to Jerusalem, and Nehemiah enlists the aid of the people, and the people begin to work. But the thread that runs through it is that God is at work in every bit of this, isn't it? That's the thread that runs through it. It's not just Nehemiah had a feeling, and Nehemiah made a decision, and Nehemiah put a sales pitch on the people, and they got, you know, moved by his sales pitch. The real thread that runs throughout is that this was a work of God, and God was using human instruments to accomplish His purpose and to bring about His work. God is at work in and upon the people's hearts. God is working through the people's labors, and God is working through providence throughout this book. You know, God is at work everywhere. God is at work in the favorable answer that Nehemiah gets from the king, allowing him to go back. God is at work in the provision the king provides, the materials and the money and the help. God is at work in the willingness of the people to, you know, commit themselves to this work. God is at work in the people's labors. God is at work in thwarting the purposes of their enemies as they try to stop the work. So, you know, this is, you know, it's a narrative. It's a narrative of historical events in the Old Testament, but it's a narrative, and through that narrative is woven the hand of God and how God often works. He burdens people for a particular task or calling. He sets them to praying because of the concern that He works in their heart. He calls people to particular tasks or particular ministries or particular places. He enables them to believe that God can work through them to bring this work about, even though the odds against it seem overwhelming. He moves on the hearts of other people, even though they may seem to be the most unlikely of people, and engages them in the work so that people join together in the labor. He enables His servants to overcome in spite of opposition, and He brings about victory even when there is opposition to the work. He works and unfolds His purpose over time. You know, over time He works to bring about His, it's not always an easy, quick thing, and we have to trust and obey. And then He Himself is always at work. He's working through, you know, the small things. I mean, you wonder I think about things like this. What would the people, the young, let's say the women or even the mother of Spurgeon, how would they have viewed their ministry to him as a child if they had known how God was going to use that ministry and what God was going to do as a result of it? Or a Bunyan. You know, who witnessed to Bunyan? I mean, who's the ones that told Bunyan about Christ and God began to deal with his heart? I had a man recently, I was over, my friend who's a mechanic, and there was a young lady and an older man standing in front of me, and he had his back turned to me, and I didn't recognize who he was, and I turned talking to the guys at work there, and well, these two people, this man and woman, come up to me, and then when I saw his face, I knew who he was. And then when I saw his face and I looked at the young lady, it was his daughter, and I hadn't seen her since she was a kid. He said, young man, we've been trying to find you. I said, well, you've been trying to find me. He said, well, he basically told me, he said, I'm dying. And told me what he had, and he said, they don't expect me to live, you know, probably much over a year, if that long. And his daughter said, yeah, I can't find you on Facebook. I said, yeah, you're probably not going to find me there. And I give him my phone number, and he said, I want you to preach my funeral. He said, I told her, and I want you to preach my funeral. He said, and he looked at me, he said, do you remember that night when we were young and we was in Houston's, and you remember witnessing to me and telling me about Christ that night? I said, yeah. I said, I remember, I witnessed to him. Some guys acted in less than a mature way, and that it made me have to work one night a week. And on that Thursday night, I was in the aisle with him working every Thursday night, and I'd witness to him, try to tell him about Christ. And he would, for the most part, he would just kind of, yeah, and kind of blow me off and ignore it. But I can remember the night that I could tell that God had struck his heart like an arrow, that God had spoken to him. And, you know, God began to call him, and eventually he was saved. And I remember how angry I was about having to work on Thursday night, because it messed my whole week up, because, you know, you're working days the rest of the week, and then that one night a week, it just messes everything up, because you basically lose your day off because of the sleeping issue, you know. And but how differently would I have viewed that if I would have known that, you know, in that simple setting, that God would eventually use my paltry and weak efforts to preach the gospel to a man, you know, and that all these years later, he's still believing and hoping in Christ. And, you know, such, you know, but the real story is not that I was doing the work. The real story is that God was doing the work. That's the real story, you know. And to me, that's a great encouragement. How differently we would view things if we realize that in the most unlikely places, in the most unlikely ways, God works out his purpose through what we all know are our paltry human efforts to obey him, you know. And God could even, you know, do great things through a Nehemiah and his people. Well, let's pray. Father, we love you. We love your word, and I pray that you will take these things and encourage us in the work that you've called us to do. And then if you ever are calling us to do something that we're not aware of, Lord, please burden us and make your call upon our life clear and help us to be obedient and then to trust you to do the work as we obey you, and to always seek the help of others, that you might bring others to help in the labor, and that in that you might work out your purposes through the surrender and the submission of the hearts of your people. Help us to be that as a church in our community, preaching the gospel, loving people, seeking just to be an instrument that you would use for your glory. In Jesus' name.